Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week we'll be talking with Peter Mendelson, author of What We See When We Read and Cover. We'll also hear from Megan Holt about this year's One Book, One New Orleans Literacy Initiative. Peter Mendelson is the Associate Art Director at Alfred A. Knopf, which publishes some of the most beautiful books I know. But recently, instead of designing books for other folks, he's celebrating the publication of two of his own, a fascinating meditation and graphic work called What We See When We Read, as well as a monograph that's a wonderful examination of the designer's art, titled simply Cover. Peter, welcome to The Reading Life.
Well, thank you for having me.
So how did it feel to design books for yourself instead of other people?
It was a much more arduous and neurotic process, frankly. Yeah, you realize that nobody else is going to approve it but you, and it gives you all of this horrible freedom. You can basically do anything you want. So, of course, you set out to do anything you want on the cover, and nothing is really good enough. And so, you know, with What We See When We Read, that cover just was, it was agony. It took forever. I begged to have other designers do it for me. The publisher ended up reminding me that it was pretty important that I do it myself. I really tried to get out of doing it as much as I could, but no one was having it. But in the end, I'm actually happy with the way it turned out. I think it's simple and hopefully effective.
It's very effective. Now, you love some of the same authors I do, and they're authors that many people love, of course. And I was looking at What We See When We Read in a restaurant the other night, and a friend who's the founder of the Dickens Fellowship here came in. And I was at that Bleak House page where you describe the opening of that novel. And I just kind of held it up to her, and she went, "Oh, that's exactly right." And we were both wowed by how perfect your description.
Oh,
so tell us about that, because beginnings of books are very important to you.
Yeah, I mean, beginnings of books are particularly interesting to me because we have so little information at the beginning. You know, I talk a little bit about Moby Dick, Call Me Ishmael. There's a character who's never really described in the book at all, and yet we feel very intimate with him. And at the opening, we sort of, you know, we follow him around New Bedford and all of his various encounters with strange new people, and somehow we have this idea of him as being a fully fledged, visible person in the book. And I just found that very interesting because, like I said, in this liminal space that is beginning a book, we know very little, and yet somehow we seem to imagine that we are imagining everything fully. And in a way, it's that kind of investigation into that strange kind of cognitive dissonance between the information we have and how fully we imagine something that really led to the writing of the book, What We See When We Read, just trying to figure out how that's possible from so few prompts from an author we can imagine something as completely as we think that we do.
Now, in Bleak House, we begin in a fog.
That's right, in a literal fog and a metaphoric fog. And we imagine that we are, in fact, seeing a fog also. Although the more kind of introspectively I try to see that fog, I find it's a very hard fog to see, which is funny because actually the idea of fog, as I said, metaphorically for a state of reading, it's a very apt metaphor in a way because things are hazy and they're not complete and we're sort of groping in a world where we stumble on new things, but they're only sort of half-formed. And, you know, fog is a wonderful metaphor, in fact, for not just the openings of books, but the way we imagine books in general. It's very foggy.
Yes, it is. And it rolls quite literally across the words on the page, which I love. Your book. Now, you read like a designer. You said that you're first and foremost a reader. So when you read a book, you're looking for clues that perhaps the rest of us might not be looking for.
Yeah, it's a very peculiar job, honestly, designing a book cover. And if you think of that job as being the job of representing visually the text, then you do have to read the book for visual occasions and emblems and metaphors. And I don't think that is the way, in fact, most people read books. It depends on the book, but I think, if you imagine reading a novel, you imagine being swept up in the narrative. And you imagine that you are, in fact, kind of passively seeing the author's world. For me, it's a much more active process. It has to be. I have to take those cues from the author and concoct something that I can actually make. So, I'm constantly marking up manuscripts as I'm reading them. Oh, this could be an interesting image, or this is an image that could bear the weight of the entire narrative on a jacket or cover. And that's not the way most people read. The problem for me is really when I read for pleasure, which I do all the time, I have to kind of consciously turn off that particular proclivity and methodology. I have to remind myself, oh, yep, you're just a normal reader now. Just, sit back and be immersed. So,
isn't that, you have to do that, though, or you'll lose all the joy in your work, too. People who read for a living, I think, have a peculiar job.
Yeah. Reading for pleasure becomes sort of a busman's holiday. I mean, you have to remember how to relax into a book rather than parse.
Right.
So I think probably critics and editors have a similar problem. Luckily, my love of reading is strong enough, so it hasn't been killed off yet by this strange job that I do. I mean, in fact, I probably read more than I ever have. I have 3 books in front of me right now that I'm reading for pleasure and probably 10 that I'm reading for work. And the pleasure that I take in it seems to be hopefully inexhaustible.
I hope so, too. Now, what we see when we read is really a phenomenology of reading. How does it unfold? How does it feel? How does it come through our senses? And I'd like to picture you as a reader. What are your best reading conditions? I mean, do you read on a screen? Do you read with strong light? Do you read at a desk? Are you drinking coffee? Where are you?
Right. Part of having to read so much is that you learn to read under basically any conditions. I read when I'm on the subway. I read when I'm in the bath. I read when I'm going to sleep. I read sometimes when I'm walking down the street. Actually, just walking from the train to work today, I was reading, and people were sort of dodging me. It's a very hazardous way to walk down the street.
Yes,
but,
it is.
If you're really immersed, you don't want to close the book. And also, it's, that's valuable reading time. So, I read in crazy kinds of conditions, and I read in every format. I mean, I would say that my reading is probably split 3 ways between, the loose manuscript paper that I read for work, the physical books that I read, and the digital reading that I do. And it feels pretty seamless to me. I don't think while I'm reading an e-book, oh, I am now reading an e-book, much in the way that I don't think about reading physical books when I'm reading them. I mean, for me, really, text is text. So like I said, I'll read any way I can in any conditions that are presented to me.
I just have to have books everywhere. I have an upstairs book, a downstairs book, a car book, a bathroom. I know what you mean.
I know.
I really do.
Yep.
Now, of course, you've gotten a major recognition for so much of your work, but one that a lot of people will be familiar with and able to picture as we talk is The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo and those Stieg Larsson books. Would you describe your process with those books a bit?
Well, they were a little unusual in that there was so much hype around them even before they were published, and there was a huge amount of expectation that they were going to do well even before they were published. And what makes that unusual is that there was a little more scrutiny than there normally is on what the jacket was going to look like. I mean, when I was working on them, I did the work that I always do. I read the manuscript, and I mark it up, and I think about it, and I design the cover sort of as I see fit. And in this case, it seemed to me that the best way to sort of represent the book was to, for those who have not read the book, it's sort of almost like a locked room mystery that takes place on an island in Sweden. It's very snowy. There's a lot of violence. It's one particular dysfunctional Swedish family is described. So those are sort of the bare bones. And the way that I thought would best kind of represent this was to have a very spare, snowy white jacket with just a single splash of blood on it. And I made this, and it was stark, and I think it worked pretty well. But it was never going to be one and out with that cover. There were just way too many stakeholders in the process, sales and marketing and the bookstores and the various people in the publishing house and, like I said, the sales force. Everybody had an opinion about what it should look like. So that one didn't fly, but, I ended up doing 50 or 60 different covers for it. And in the end, you know, we just opted for doing something a little bit different for a thriller, a crime novel, and that is to not have the blood or the murder weapon or the shadowy guy, but rather to just have something that was sort of colorful and interesting.
And then you did those a second time. You did that gorgeous box set.
That's right. It was fun to do the box set, which is very spare and much closer to, in a way, to the way that I would have probably designed the books in the first place. But, you know, you can't argue with the success of that series. They did really well. I don't know if the cover contributed or not. I'd like to think maybe a little bit. But, yeah, it was an incredibly fun and interesting experience. And it was nice to be, even in a small way, affiliated with something that was such a hit.
Well, one of the things that's so interesting to me is that you kind of fell into this without really knowing much about it. You were a concert pianist, which
yep.
I wonder if your musical background has made you a more sensitive kind of reader. I wonder if you think that. But tell a little bit about that, because it's such an interesting story.
Well, you know, I was always the not visual one in my nuclear family. My sister's a painter, and my father's was an architect and then a sculptor, and my mom works at the Metropolitan Museum, and you know, a lot of visual people in my family, and I was sort of the one who hated to go to museums, and I was always the one with the ears. I played music since I was four, and I always just figured I would be a classical pianist for my entire life. It was really a surprise in my 30s when it seemed like maybe something should shift. And mostly it's for financial reasons. You know, I've been, like I said, I'd gone to conservatory and, you know, I was performing, but it's a very hard life, both emotionally and just in terms of eking out a living. And when I started to think about other things that I enjoyed doing other than playing the piano, it was hard to come up with anything, but drawing and sketching and doodling, that's something I've always done. I've always sort of loved making things that are in the visual realm. And I designed a couple of things at that point. I designed my wedding invitation and some t-shirts for friends and, you know, posters for friends' bands and little things like that. And I'd always really enjoyed doing it. So my wife had suggested that maybe this could be a career path. And over the course of, I don't know, somewhere between 6 months and a year, I went to Barnes & Noble and bought a bunch of design books and books that would teach me the appropriate software, and somehow managed to cobble together a portfolio. And my first job interview was with Chip Kidd at Knopf. And reader, I was hired. I mean, you know, less than a year after I quit the piano, I had basically one of the best jobs in the business. And I've been there ever since, coming up on 12 years now.
Nothing like starting at the top, you know? It's just...
I didn't realize it was the top at the time. Like you said, I didn't really know anything about that.
I know. What was so funny was the person who introduced you said, you know, you knew he liked Batman. I mean...
yeah, that's all I knew.
Which is great.
But, you know, ignorance can be wonderful in some ways, you know, you really, there wasn't any of the anxiety around, oh, you know, here's Sonny Mehta, the big cheese, and here's Chip Kidd, the great book cover designer. Like, I never really felt that. They seemed like people to me. They still do. And of course, I admire all the incredible work that they've done, but at least I wasn't anxious about it at the job interview.
Well, you work at an amazing place. Now, in Cover, which is this gorgeous coffee table book, it's a must for anyone who loves books and design. You describe your evolution as a designer, and one of the things I really love is that you include a lot of jackets that weren't finally used. You know, you're truly showing the evolution of some of these ideas. So do you think people are more aware of this as a possible artistic calling now as a job?
You know, I hope so. It's interesting. I just got an email today from a girl who's a high school student who was saying it just never occurred to her that this was a thing, that you could somehow marry a love of the visual with a love of reading. So I hope now that people are thinking of this as, you know, for those weirdos like me who like to make visual art and who are avid readers, that there actually is a profession that exists at the intersection of those two interests. You know, it's interesting about the killed covers and the covers that were never made. It never occurred to me when I put them in that people would find them so interesting. It's such a part of my daily life here. But actually, more than anything, that's what people have reported that they loved about Cover, is just sort of seeing the process, you know, and seeing sort of the covers that could have been. I find it interesting that people are just so endlessly fascinated by that. The also-rans, you know.
Well, I think that some of them are just very beautiful, and you should argue for going back and redoing them in the future.
Okay.
Oh, we've been talking with Peter Mendelsohn, whose two new books are What We See When We Read and Cover. They will make you look at books in a whole new way. Thank you so much, Peter.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Megan Holt is a postdoctoral teaching fellow in the Tulane University English Department, who's very involved with the Young Leadership Council's One Book, One New Orleans Reading Initiative. This is a wonderful effort that began in 2004 with Ernest Gaines, A Lesson Before Dying, and continues to the present. Welcome to The Reading Life, Megan.
Thank you for having me.
Now, I know there were a lot of books being considered for this year's One Book, One New Orleans selection. So, drum roll, please. What is the book for this year?
The 2014 One Book, One New Orleans selection is Unfathomable City, A New Orleans Atlas by Rebecca Solnit and Rebecca Snedeker.
Yay!
We're thrilled.
Isn't that fun to get to say that?
It's a wonderful book.
So there were a number of books in contention for this, as there always are. What is it about this book that you think makes it such a great selection?
There are a couple of things. First and foremost, you can see yourself in this book. Whether you're a transplant to New Orleans, whether you're a native, you can see your neighborhood, you can see your friends, you can see your family. And second of all, I think it really does encourage reading because even those of us who may not enjoy reading so much will like to spend time with this book. The book is a collection of 22 maps and essays, and the maps are just visually arresting. Sometimes I catch myself looking at the book more than I catch myself reading the book. So it's a great resource both about our city and about who we are at this moment in time as New Orleanians, and it's beautiful to see.
It really is beautiful. I mean, it is an atlas in both the traditional and the very unconventional sense.
Yes.
So what are some of the programming opportunities you see that this book offers? Because it offers some unusual ones.
It does. One of the things that we're really excited about is a map of New Orleans literacy that's going to come out with our partnership from the Literacy Alliance of Greater New Orleans. In conjunction with them, we're doing mapping adult literacy, and we're going to do an art exhibit with that. We're also going to do a discussion based on one of the maps, the map called Juju and Cuckoo, about mental spiritual health here in New Orleans. We're going to have a benefit for Louisiana Books to Prisoners based on the map and essay Lockdown Louisiana, and the map is called Of Levees and Prisons. Some great programming opportunities.
Now, what are the things that go into consideration when you're choosing the book for this event?
Obviously, first and foremost, we want our community to be able to see themselves in it. Secondly, we very much try to look for conversation pieces because the whole idea of fostering a sense of community through literacy is that if I'm in one place in New Orleans and you're in another, but we've read the same book, now we have something in common. And this book is nothing if not a conversation starter.
And you do special outreach to schools and literacy programs.
Yes. The bulk of our books go to the Literacy Alliance of Greater New Orleans, and they actually develop a curriculum around it, and we'll use that in their adult ed, ESL, and GED classes. So that way, members of our community who normally wouldn't have access to the community of readers get that kind of access.
And how many books do you give away?
This year, approximately 450.
That's great. I love to think of those books just, you know, taking wing over
yes.
New Orleans. It's such a gorgeous thing. And for an author, this is an amazing tribute. It's really fun to see the authors react to this.
It is.
So whatever the two Rebeccas said.
They're so gracious. They have been wonderful resources. They've asked how they can help. They've agreed to fly in the case of Rebecca Solnit, for the kickoff party on September 11th. She'll be there, and she'll be doing a keynote address. Snedeker's moderating one of the panels. They've just been so gracious, so thrilled. And it's wonderful to be able to cultivate those relationships with authors who've put in so much time into writing about our city and really getting to know it.
And there's so many authors represented in this book as well.
Yes.
That's really exciting, too.
Yes, authors and artists.
So tell us a little bit about the kickoff event. When do things really get underway? How long is the reading period?
Well, obviously, you can start reading now. The official kickoff is September 11th, and that will be at the Public House on Ferret Street.
And everyone's welcome, right?
Yes. Well, you have to be 21 for this one.
Ah.
But all of our events are free and open to the public, and the kickoff is the only one that does not allow minors.
And is there a website where people can go and get more information?
I think the best bet would be to follow us on Facebook. So just look up One Book, One New Orleans on Facebook, and we post almost daily about literacy in the city, things that our community partners do, our kickoff events, ways that you can get involved. All of that information will be found on that page.
Now, a lot of people at the Young Leadership Council work really hard to make this happen. What is it that keeps you interested as a volunteer in One Book?
Honestly, I think I have to tell a story to answer that. When I was in college, I tutored a functionally illiterate man. He was 72, and he wanted to read a bedtime story to his great-grandchild. So we worked, and we worked, and we worked. And one day, he comes up to me, and he's so excited, and he says, "Megan, did you know that there are signs above the aisles in the grocery store that tell you where things are?" And that was really when I realized how much those of us who've had access to the printed word our whole life take it for granted. And that's what keeps me, and I think everyone who's working with One Book, One New Orleans involved, is it's a way to put the printed word into the hands of those who would normally not have access to it, and then invite those people into a larger community of readers and say, "Welcome. It's a great life."
Right. Stories like that really make you realize what a privilege it is to read and how necessary it is for getting along in the world.
Exactly.
The other thing I was curious about is the Young Leadership Council's One Book Project has always had this traditional connection with Books to Prisoners.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit more about that project as well.
Louisiana Books to Prisoners is an amazing project. I'm just now realizing how powerful it is. Because a lot of those of us who just hear the name assume that they just send books to prisons.
Mm-hmm.
What they actually do is they take letters from people all over the Southeast, prisoners themselves, and they will read each one of these letters. And they try to match the books that they have to the actual prisoner's request.
Wow.
And they send a package to that individual person filled with the books that they ask for, either specifically or the closest they can find.
Wow.
It's amazing.
So that means packing those books
every
Sunday is a real labor of love.
Yes, they pack every Sunday.
Wow.
And actually, the most requested item, surprisingly enough, dictionaries. Dictionaries of any kind. Spanish, English, legal dictionaries, college dictionaries, any paperback dictionary. So that will be what our event focuses on. Instead of having a book drive in general, we're doing a dictionary drive.
Just say when. I have many dictionaries I can spare.
September 18th.
September 18th. All right. Load them up and bring them over.
Please do.
Oh. Well, some of the other books that have been part of One Book over the years have been, you know, like real New Orleans classics.
Mm-hmm.
Rising Tide by John Barry. Coming Out the Door for the Ninth Ward by Nine mm-hmm. Times. Social and Pleasure Club. City of Refuge by Tom Piazza. Gumbo Tales by Sarah Rowan. Satchmo, My Life in New Orleans. That was a special year, the Louis Armstrong biography. Nine Lives, Mystery, Magic, Life and Death in New Orleans by Dan Baum, and The World That Made New Orleans, From Spanish Silver to Congo Square by Ned Sublette, and Louisiana by Erna Brodbur, which was last year's choice.
Yes.
And how did that go? That was your special area of scholarly endeavor as well.
Right. That was my first year on the project. And it was a wonderful, wonderful learning experience for me. I got to know so much more about the city and about what makes this place truly unique and special through reading that book and then interacting with the different people who did the programming for it. It was wonderful. And I think it set us up nicely for this year.
Well, keep up the good work. I'm glad you're still inspired.
Yes.
Oh.
And before we wrap, I would love to thank our community partners, Shell, the Literacy Alliance of Greater New Orleans, WRBH Radio for the Blind, New Orleans Public Library, and of course, Louisiana Books to Prisoners.
Great. We've been talking with Megan Holt, who teaches at Tulane University and is working with the Young Leadership Council's One Book, One New Orleans initiative. Thank you so much, Megan.
Thank you again for having me, Susan. It's been great.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Morgan Moulthrop discusses in Science Andrew Jackson's Playbook, 15 Strategies for Success, Tuesday, September 9th at 6 at Octavia Books. Keith Weldon Medley, author of We as Freemen, Plessy v. Ferguson, and the upcoming Black Life in Old New Orleans, appears Tuesday, September 9th at 6:30 at the Hubble Library. Award-winning education reporter Sarah Carr lectures about her book, Hope Against Hope, Three Schools, One City, and the Struggle to Educate America's Children. That's this year's Tulane Reading Project selection. Wednesday, September 10th at 6:30 at Dixon Hall at Tulane University. Open to anyone. Nicholas Meese discusses in Science New Orleans, Hurricanes from the Start. Wednesday, September 10th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Sherry Lee Alexander, Larry Lorenz, and Vicki Mayer discuss The Times-Picayune in a Changing Media World. Thursday, September 11th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Romney Diaz, Steve Dumez, Byron Mouton, and Elizabeth Mossop discuss New Orleans Under Reconstruction, The Crisis of Planning. Thursday, September 11th at 6 at the Playhouse at Longview. Today's guest, Megan Holt, appears at the One Book, One New Orleans kickoff to discuss Unfathomable City, a New Orleans Atlas. That's Thursday, September 11th at the Public House on Ferret from 5:30 to 8 p.m. The Octavia Books Science Fiction Book Club discusses Thomas Dish's The Dreams Our Stuff Is Made Of, How Science Fiction Conquered the World, Saturday, September 13th at 10:30 at Octavia Books. The Dickens Fellowship of New Orleans begins its year-long discussion of Bleak House, Saturday, September 13th from 2 to 4 at the Bright Library at Metairie Park Country Day School. Start with chapters 1 through 8. Jessamyn Ward discusses and signs the paperback edition of her memoir, Men We Reaped, Tuesday, September 16th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Maple Street Bookshop celebrates its 50th anniversary. That's right, the Big 5-0, the weekend of September 12th. Events get underway Friday, September 12th, with a One Book, One New Orleans discussion of Unfathomable City, a New Orleans Atlas, with editor Rebecca Snedeker. That's Friday, September 12th at 6:30. Saturday, September 13th is Children's Day at the shop with the following local authors. 11:30, Ryan Murphy and Grace Millsap sign What the Sleepy Animals Do at the Audubon Zoo. At 12:30, there's a lunch with the Big Class Bookmaking Initiative. At 1, Diane de las Casas signs Cinderelephant. And at 2, Kid Chef Eliana talks about her Cool Kids Cook cookbooks and presents a cooking demonstration. STARE, Start the Adventure in Reading, continues its training sessions for volunteers who are willing to work with school children who need help with reading. Sessions during the coming week will be held Wednesday, September 10th, from 1:30 to 3:30 at St. Martin's Episcopal Church, 2216 Metairie Road in Metairie. Thursday, September 11th, from 4:30 to 6 at St. Charles Avenue Presbyterian Church, in the Land Building on State Street. This is a special session for college students. There will be another training session Monday, September 15th, from 1:30 to 3:30, also at the Land Building. For more information, go to starenola.org. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.